Welcome to this audio presentation on conflict in teams. The first point I want to emphasise is that conflict is inevitable. Wherever you get a group of people together, there is bound to be some degree of disagreement, differences of perspective, and so on. So it is unrealistic then to aim for a conflict-free team. The real challenge is working out how teams can best deal with conflicts rather than naively try to avoid them altogether. We need to be clear, though, about what we mean by conflict. To a lot of people, conflict is the same as hostility or fighting, and that's not a helpful way of looking at it, because conflict comes across a major continuum, ranging from fairly minor disagreements at one end to violent confrontations at the other. And so when we use the term conflict, we shouldn't automatically assume that we are at the violent extreme or even anywhere near it. Conflict is an everyday occurrence in the sense that people will constantly be having differences of perspective and trying to tackle things in different ways. But in the vast majority of situations, people handle these conflicts very skillfully, without any difficulty whatsoever. So conflict is not necessarily a problem, although it can become one if it's allowed to escalate and get closer towards that pole of hostility, fighting, and so on. So we have to recognise then that in any group of people there will be differences, and that applies to teams as well, of course. On the one hand, from a negative point of view, we look at this, we can see that there is a danger that such differences can escalate to produce increasing degrees of tension and then potentially hostility, making the team a very ineffective one. But it doesn't have to be that way. We can also look at the differences positively. We can see them as part of a strategy of valuing diversity. So it can be a case of trying to reap the benefits of different perspectives and outlooks. So when there are different people in a team with different experiences, different outlooks and so on, that can of course lead to tensions and difficulties, but it doesn't have to. Another way of looking at it is to see these as part of the rich tapestry of diversity and for teams to explore how they can capitalise on their differences, to look at the value that diversity brings to people. There is a lot of evidence to show that teams where people are too alike, where they are too similar in terms of their background and so on, can be teams that will not flourish. There will be little learning, little creativity, and perhaps a lot of defensiveness because people want to make sure that their safe way of being similar to each other stays that way over time. On the other hand, where there are lots of differences, if these are managed positively and constructively, then there can be tremendous benefits from having that breadth of approach and the opportunities for creativity and learning that this will bring to people. What it all boils down to, of course, is how people manage differences, whether it's done positively or negatively, or helpfully and or unhelpfully. That's the sort of thing that we need to consider. How are differences managed in your team? Is it in a positive, helpful way, or a negative, unhelpful way? Now, to explore this in a little more detail, I've identified 7 steps that can be taken to develop a positive team working arrangement where conflict is not a problem but is actually part of the benefits of diversity. So what I'm going to do now is to talk about each of the 7 steps in turn, beginning logically enough with step 1. The first step is to recognize that difference is not necessarily a problem. This is, of course, the philosophy of valuing diversity, but it's amazing how many people have failed to take that on board and still continue to see difference as a problem. Of course, teams have to recognise that they should not expect everyone to be the same. This can be highly problematic if there is too much similarity within a team and you don't have that breadth of perspective that brings with it the learning creativity that I mentioned earlier. So, step one then is to be crystal clear that differences are not necessarily a problem. If people disagree, if there are different perspectives being brought to the table, as it were, then that's not a problem necessarily. It can become a problem if it's not handled well, but in itself, it's an opportunity to explore ways to improve the way the team functions and to learn from each other. So having a positive outlook on difference and trying to recognise the opportunities and benefits involved is a necessary first step. The second step is to establish whether everybody's included in the team, or are there people who are in people and some who are out people. It's not uncommon in groups of people, including teams, for certain members to not be regarded as full members, in a sense, that there are subtle ways in which they are given a secondary status in the team. Where that happens, it can create additional conflicts and tensions that can be unhelpful. So an important thing to do is to review the membership of the team and to be clear, is everybody in the team a full member of the team, or is there some sort of implicit hierarchy that includes some people and excludes others? If you find from reviewing the team that not everyone is included, then you have to ask yourselves, what can be done to change this? What steps can we take to improve this situation? Step 3. Following on from step 2, we need to be clear about whether there are any cliques or subgroups in the team. So while step 2 was about looking at the team in terms of individuals, this is a step further in terms of looking at whether there are subgroups. Now, if there are such subgroups, that's not necessarily a problem. Teams can work very well, especially large teams, if there are subgroupings. The question, though, the very big question is the way such subgroups are organised within the team helpful or unhelpful? Does having any sort of unofficial subgroupings help the team to function better by making tasks more manageable, for example? Or does it create unnecessary division by, for example, creating an us-them mentality for some people at least? So that's another important thing to review, to look at whether there is any evidence that there are subgroups or cliques, as they're often known, and if there are, to establish whether that works well for the team or creates problems. And clearly, if it creates problems, that's something that needs to be addressed within the team. Step 4. Are the team's goals clear, explicit, and agreed? If not, people will be pulling in different directions, and that can then create a great deal of negative conflict. It can waste a lot of time and energy. It can create resentment and ill feeling. It is not uncommon for teams to be working on the basis of a set of assumed goals. That is, they have never been made explicit. I have done a lot of work as an external facilitator with various teams, particularly teams that have been having difficulties in some way or form. And it is very common in such circumstances for me to find that there is either no explicit statement of goals, and so people are interpreting what the team is all about in different ways and therefore pulling in different directions. Or in some cases, there is an explicit statement of goals, but the way these are interpreted in practice is very different, And again, you then have the problem of people pulling in different directions, in a sense getting in each other's way, with the effect of preventing the team from functioning as a whole and from getting people into a position where they can help each other to achieve shared goals. So that's another thing to review then. Are the team's goals clear, explicit and agreed? And if they're not, then perhaps some work needs to be done to change that so that you're in a stronger position to move forward together. Step 5. Is it clear, explicit and agreed how the goals will be achieved? It's no good having agreed explicit goals, for example, if people then have different ideas about how they're going to implement them and don't express those differences so that they can be used constructively. Instead, they plough their own furrow so that superficially it looks as though everybody's on the same wavelength because there are agreed explicit goals, but different people are going in different directions to try and achieve them. Teams need to be organic in the sense that you can't expect everybody to do the same thing. But those different functions, those different organs of the body, as it were, need to be interlinking and supporting one another for the overall goals of the team. But if there is a lack of clarity about what needs to be done to achieve the goals, then that can undermine the team's efforts to achieve them. So again, it's something that can be usefully reviewed, is to clarify not only what are the goals of the team, are those agreed, but also is it agreed what needs to be done in order to achieve those goals, to arrive at those outcomes, as it were. Step 6. Does the team communicate effectively? If not, there will be no sense of shared endeavour. It's a very common problem in teams for communication to either not take place at all about certain issues. They become sort of taboo, in a sense, and not addressed at all, while others may be communicated about in a very ineffective way. So reviewing the communication patterns of the team can be a very helpful step. For example, team meetings. Does genuine communication take place at a team meeting? In my experience, team meetings are often fairly bureaucratic. They can amount to just having information passed down from above, as it were, the latest edicts, as it were. Whereas, of course, a fully functioning, effective team meeting should have a bonding effect. It should facilitate genuine, meaningful communication so that people feel that they have gained some benefit from being in the same room as their colleagues for however long the meeting lasts, rather than see it as, sadly, many teams often do, as a sort of something that has to be tolerated because it is expected of them. So team meeting is a key part of how effectively a team communicates, but of course it's not just about team meetings. There's more to it than that in terms of reviewing what channels of communication exist in the team. Are there any that are missing? Are there any that are ineffective? Are there any that are counterproductive? And sometimes that can be more effectively done by somebody outside of the team who's not part of the culture, as it were. But it can be done from within if you look closely and carefully and analytically at communication within the team. Then the final step, step 7, is to ask yourselves, when conflicts do arise, do you deal with them assertively and constructively? This is about avoiding the two extremes. On the one hand, there can be the destructive extreme of point scoring, of where conflicts arise, people regard it as some sort of fight or battle, and so they want to win, they want to score points. They want to establish victory and thereby establish someone else as a loser. Clearly that's not helpful in a team context. That's not going to facilitate effective team working or generate a sense of shared endeavour and camaraderie. At the other extreme, we can have the destructive way of handling conflict by pretending they're not there, the sort of head in the sand approach, or sweeping them under the carpet. Choose your metaphor. Either one gets across the point that often teams will be aware that there are conflicts, but they choose not to address them. They take the naive and potentially dangerous approach of hoping they will just go away. And that, of course, is potentially very dangerous, as those conflicts can fester over time and do a lot of harm, or they can be smouldering for a long time and then burst into flames in terms of major outburst of hostility or tension. Either way, that's not helpful for a team of people trying to work constructively together. So those are the seven steps. I would suggest that if you have concerns about conflict in your team, you should listen again to those seven steps and see if you can identify which one or ones is not working in your team. And of course, it is likely that there will be one or more of these that are not working, because no team is perfect. It is sadly uncommon for there to be a lot of destructive conflict in teams, so that instead of differences, as I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, being seen as potentially productive aspects of diversity, they become weapons that people use against each other and thereby totally undermine any sense of team spirit or shared endeavour. Now, one last point I want to emphasise is the significance of leadership. Of course, leadership is important, and whoever is officially designated the leader of the team has a role, a key role, in terms of trying to produce an effective, well-oiled team that is a good place for everybody to work. But the point I would want to emphasise is that in the best teams, everyone is a leader. All people are pulling together for the common good. In fact, expecting the leader to do all the work can be a problem in teams, that team members can sit back and expect the leader to resolve all the difficulties. And of course, that then makes it much harder for the leader to be effective. What is needed is what some people refer to as responsible followership, which I regard as a form of leadership in its own right. In other words, if you are aware that there are problems in your team, then you and your colleagues can all play a part in trying to resolve that. And that, in a sense, is surely what teamwork is all about, where it's not about just doing your own thing and hoping that someone else will address the problems, but taking shared ownership. And I want to emphasise that term ownership. I'm not talking about blame. Take shared ownership for the team, to recognise that if there are problems, then it's important to pull together in whatever ways you can. Key to that, of course, is recognising what the problems are, and hopefully the seven steps I've outlined can be helpful in that regard. But above all, communicating with one another, putting the issues on the table, as it were, and dealing with them constructively. Hope you found this useful. Good luck in putting the ideas into practice. Thank you.